Well, today's text does come from Ecclesiastes 7. I shall read it for Job, and then he will preach. Starts like this: a good name is better than precious ointment, and the day of death than the day of birth. It is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by sadness of face the heart is made glad. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the hearts of fools is in the house of mirth. It is better for a man to hear the rebuke of the wise than to hear the song of fools. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This also is vanity. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Better is the end of a thing than its beginning, and the patient in spirit is better than the proud in spirit. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it is not from wisdom that you ask this. Wisdom is good with an inheritance, an advantage to those who see the sun. For the protection of wisdom is like the protection of money, and the advantage of knowledge is that wisdom preserves the life of him who has it. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. In the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. This is the word of the Lord.
Amen. Thanks so much, Darren. It is good to be with you again. And I do bring a greeting from Rosalie Baptist Church. We love that there are gospel-proclaiming communities all across Queensland in particular, southeast Queensland. And we love to have a partnership with you guys down here. If you're ever in Brisbane and you're going past Rosalie, which is in there near Suncourt Stadium, that sort of area, feel free to drop in. We may be there and catch up. It'd be great. All right, Ecclesiastes, you guys have been trekking through this and you've been going through this journey, which is, it is a slog, it's tough, it's real, and it's in some ways just super captivating. So let's continue to dig into this complicated and bizarre but beautiful text. All right, Heath Ledger and his portrayal of the Joker in Christopher Nolan's Batman series is arguably one of the most captivating depictions of a villain of all time. I think one of the beautiful things about the way he acts this role is that the Joker walks this tightrope line between being completely and utterly insane and off the chain entirely, and yet at the same time he is a brilliant mastermind. And all his pieces go into exactly the places he wants them to go. He is just a spectacular, deranged villain. Part of his persona is his disfigured face with scars that have permanently carved his mouth into the shape of a smile. And he actually has a couple of different stories in the movie about how he got the scars. And these stories are not designed to make us feel sympathy for him because they're different every time, but rather they're designed to make us feel like this guy is just whack. He is crazy. It magnifies his deranged and unpredictable nature. One of the stories, probably the most captivating, is of his abusive father beating his mother, and the poor boy Joker is watching on, obviously terrified, obviously sad, obviously just downcast at what is taking place. And the father comes over to him and says to him, "Why so serious?" And then takes out a knife and carves the smile into his face as if to say, "Even if I'm beating your mother to death, you still should be happy." The story shocks us. That is a shocking story about just how cruel and mentally disturbed someone would have to be in order to take an upset boy and carve a smile into their face. The idea that his seriousness and his sadness at an obviously serious and sad scene would need to be rectified, that this smile would need to be carved across his face as a way of masking the horror that he was forced to endure. This appalls us. And yet, I want to propose this evening that in a very real way, it is how so many people live their lives. So many of us walk through life trying to avoid anything that might be perceived to be too serious. And we will do anything we can to carve a smile over the top of the sad and serious parts of life. A child or a friend is upset and we're awkward dealing with their sadness. And so we say something like, cheer up, it'll be okay. We carve a smile across the situation. Or better still, we feel compelled to make light of the situation, to find something funny or to say, you know, we're probably going to laugh about this one day. Carving a smile over the top of the sorrow. We do everything we can to communicate unpleasant things in trivial or positive way. It's like we can't handle dwelling on anything that is upsetting or depressing. And like the Joker's father, we're constantly berating those around us who might do anything to dampen the mood. Why so serious? This is one of the reasons that we've become so addicted to trivial things in this world, like the trivial and frivolous side of social media, because anytime something in our life is getting a bit too intense, we can always find some parody news article, a TikTok dance, or a Leonardo DiCaprio meme to lighten our mood. The Joker's sadistic tale might shock us, but the sad same attitude permeates our desire to carve a smile over everything in our life. And this even happens in the church. As a young preacher, I am sure I made plenty of mistakes when I was setting out. I was 18 or so when I preached my first sermon, and I'm pretty sure that I didn't always get things right. But as I continued to preach, one pastor that was giving me input kept saying to me, why do you have to be so serious about stuff? I mean, I looked out at one point, you were preaching and everyone sort of had their heads down and they were like, just really serious. And I'm like, well, the passage was serious. Like, it was there. It was difficult. I wasn't going to hide that from the people. But he said, you need to lighten the mood with a joke from time to time so that it's not so intense for people. Even in the church, we have this desire to carve a smile over the top of everything that just seems a little bit serious. And so as a church, you've been journeying through Ecclesiastes. And hopefully you've seen that this guy who's speaking, the main voice here, Qohelet, this teacher, could never be accused of this Joker-like attitude. In fact, if anything, Qohelet has been the guy that we've wanted to carve a smile over the top of. He's the one who's been throwing the proverbial wet blanket over our experience of life. But coming to chapter 7, perhaps we'll see why he has been doing this. This evening we're going to wrestle with the ugliness of life and why it is vital that we actually take the time to contemplate the negative, the depressing, the unpleasant, the serious parts of our existence, rather than just looking for ways to lighten the mood. We're going to see two reasons we must fight the urge to carve a smile over the top of our lives. Chapter 7 begins with Qohelet expounding a series of four statements of comparison. The first is kind of like a base level comparison, something so affirmative that everyone would agree. Verse 1, a good name is better than precious ointment. A good name, a good reputation, something that sticks with you for your life, the legacy that you leave is far better than a perfume which you put on one day and then have to reapply the next. It wafts away over the course of a day. Everyone would agree that a good reputation is so much better than just a perfume. What Qohelet is doing here is framing the comparisons that are to come. The first comparison establishes a pattern. It's like he's saying, in the same way that it's obvious that a good name is better than ointment, so too should you consider the comparisons that are to come. And this is important because the comparisons that are to come are far less appealing than the first. Verse 1 again, the day of death is better than the day of birth. Verse 2, it's better to go to a house of mourning than a house of feasting. Verse 3, sorrow is better than laughter. And then there's this final statement, which is like a conclusion. For by sadness of face, the heart is made glad. This is where we might be tempted to ask Qehelet, why so serious? Because his suggestions seem ridiculous. He's basically saying that you're better off going to a funeral than a birthday party. Better off dwelling on your failures than your successes. If you're a Winnie the Pooh fan, you're better off being like Eeyore than being like Tigger. And he goes as far as to say in verse 4, the heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. How can this be true? When each of my girls were born, I got, as dad, to spend some time while mum was recovering from birth. I got to spend time with my girls. And it's always lived in my memory, this precious moment, the day of their birth, when I got to look into their eyes for the first time, hold this precious gift that I'd never seen before but could never love more than I did in that moment. At least that's what you think. You're wrapped up in their existence and you think, How, Qehelet, can this be the worse option? How can that be so much worse than going to a funeral and farewelling someone that you love? How can this beautiful, precious moment be so bad? Well, it's not that it's bad in and of itself, but it's not the best. That's what Qehelet's saying. Because thinking about that moment when I held each of my girls, part of the attraction of that moment is you're thinking everything that this child will experience in life, all that lies ahead of them. There's this beautiful sense of the joyous and wonderful life they're going to lead. You've got this vision of this little baby girl growing into a toddler, into a girl, into a woman, and going out into this world and everything that she will experience. Well, you flash forward a bit, don't you? And you see everything your children go through. And everything they go through isn't the joyous, hopeful wonder that you hope for them on that day. It's entirely different. They go through hardship. They go through difficulty. They get bullied at school. People hate on them. They get sick. They get injured. Things go rubbish in their life from time to time. It's kind of like you have this skewed perspective. If all I ever thought about my girls was that moment of hopeful and wishes for their future, if that's all I ever thought and didn't care for anything that was actually really happening in their life, I would be a deluded father who didn't care for my daughters at all. And on the day of birth, all you've got is just hopeful wishes. But when you go to a funeral, you see something very different. You look back over someone's life. You hear the eulogy and you get a perspective of the ups and downs, the roller coaster that this person lived through. You see the highs, you see the lows, you see everything. You see the whole picture. The perspective you get from celebrating a birth, in some ways, it's only a mask that covers over the reality of what lays ahead for that child. At a funeral, you get a much deeper and honest perspective on life. You see the end and you are confronted by the reality of eternity, just how short our lives are. You see the perspective you get from thinking about death actually teaches you something by confronting you with the cold, hard reality of our fragility. This is what Qehelet calls wisdom. Wisdom to Qehelet is a perspective only gained when things are viewed in the context of a real life, not a hopeful, not an idealistic, not a wishful life. It's so easy for us to look for our triumphs and achievements, to our wins and successes, to take our perspective from the house of feasting, the times we have celebrated. But look at verse 6. For as the crackling of thorns under a pot, so is the laughter of fools. This is also vanity. Over the last year or so, I've tried my hand at smoking meat. I built a smoker out of a 44-gallon drum, and I've been trying to perfect my brisket. One thing I know, I'm no pit master by any stretch of the imagination, but one thing I do know is that you have to have the right fuel to make that smoker burn, because the fire in a smoker needs to burn for 12, 14 hours. This thing has got to burn for a long, long time. So you need big, hunky chunks of hardwood, or you need those super compressed carbon heat beads or briquettes and things that are going to burn for a long time. If I was to get my smoker going with a whole bunch of thin, dry twigs, it would look spectacular. It'll burn up out of the drum. It would look amazing, but it would produce no lasting heat whatsoever. It would produce nothing of value. Even if I wanted to boil water on that fire, it wouldn't burn for long enough just to boil water, let alone smoke meat for 12 hours. Well, here in verse 6, Qehelet likens listening to the laughter of fools, the merry, gladsome memories of our wins, the song you hear in the house of celebration. He likens this to the powerless crackle of burning thorns, thin, dry twigs. They make all sorts of noise and give off bright sparks, but the resultant flame carries no long-lasting heat. Nothing of practical value. It's all just show. Instead of listening to this powerless crackle in the house of feasting, Qehelet calls us to spend time in the house of mourning, to verse 5, to hear the rebuke of the wise, to take our perspective from the sober reality of suffering and the brevity of our lives. It is here and only here that our perspective on ourselves is placed in its proper place compared to God Himself. This is another way of saying the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Because when everything is going awesome in your life, when you're in the house of celebration, when you are feasting, you're not thinking about the bigness of God, are you? Who are you thinking about the bigness of? Me. I had the win. I'm big. That's where you think about the bigness of yourself. But in the face of mourning and weakness and our failures and the seriousness of life, God is the one that you cling to. Unless you are humbled by seeing your life compared to the greatness of God, you will never know true wisdom. And this is the first reason we must fight the urge to carve a smile over everything in our life. Because it's only when we are faced with the depressing, the sorrowful, and the serious realities of lives that we can view things from a sober point of view and make right assessments. By way of application here, Qehelet gives three warnings. Each of these is the direct result of a life that has either spent too long in the house of celebration or a life that desperately wants to be there more than anything else. Verse 7. Surely oppression drives the wise into madness, and a bribe corrupts the heart. People who are frustrated with the oppressions of life will go mad to liberate themselves from it. They will get tricked into taking bribes because they crave money that will purchase their release. Basically, we make foolish decisions when we are consumed with chasing a better life for ourselves. Do you know where the pokies make the most money? In the poorest suburbs. Why? They don't have the money to put in them, but they have the desire to get out of their situation more than anyone else. They're consumed with wealth. They're consumed with getting it. They don't have much, but what they do have, they're willing to risk on the pokies so that they can get out of that situation. It's the same with this concept of the bribe. Those who are consumed with their wealth, trying to get a house of celebration gathered around them, they will take any money that's on offer, no matter what they have to compromise to get it. That's unwise. It's foolish, but it comes from wanting to be in the house of celebration rather than the house of sorrow. Look at verse 9. Be not quick in your spirit to become angry, for anger lodges in the heart of fools. Why does anger lodge in the heart of a fool? Because the fool has embedded himself in the house of celebration. And anything that threatens his place there, that is a vile enemy that deserves his wrath. Anything that's going to steal my comfort, anything that's going to take away my prosperity, anything that's going to threaten my existence in this place of celebration, that is my enemy. And there's no room for forgiveness when somebody wrongs you. There's no room for gentleness when somebody steals from you. Vengeance must be swift. Vengeance must be fierce. Anger lodges in the heart of a fool because the fool loves the house of celebration. And anything that seeks to take him away deserves his anger. That's foolish. Why? Because his desire is to stay in the house of celebration rather than the house of mourning. And look at verse 10. Say not, why were the former days better than these? For it's not from wisdom that you ask this. When we find ourselves in the house of mourning, it's easy to completely miss the good things God wants us to teach there, because all we are ever asking is, how did things get so bad? Remember when we used to have money? Remember when we were young and healthy? Remember when culture was more accepting of me and my way of life? Remember when we didn't have a care in the world? Those were the days. The fool can't see anything helpful about the house of mourning, and so thrusts her heart back to the good old days and gets lost in reliving past glories. Past glories that can never actually be recaptured or retrieved. She is consumed with a past fantasy. That's foolish. Why? Because her heart is in the house of celebration. And the house of celebration was in her past, so she's forever living in the past, living in the glory days, rather than learning what God has for her in the house of mourning. These are not just foolish things because they seem bad to us. They are foolish because they flow out of a life that prizes a place in the house of celebration more than anything else. A life that has let present circumstances determine whether or not they're happy. This is the folly of crackling twigs on a fire. Spectacular, but short-lived and painfully useless. However, true wisdom, this perspective gained from spending time in the house of mourning, is true value. In verses 11 and 12, Qehelet declares that true wisdom is good for all who live under the sun. That it's a protection similar to having a large deposit of money in the bank. If I gave you $20 billion today and said, it's yours, it's in the bank, no one will ever take it away. It's yours for life. You'd live a very different life, wouldn't you? You would live a very, not just a life of luxury, but you'd be more willing to take risks, wouldn't you? Oh, I've got all this money in the bank. I can do the things that I really need to do regardless of the cost, because the cost is paid for. It's done. That's the true wisdom. It gives you this massive deposit of everything is good. You're learning something here. You're growing. You're in a place that is good, even if it is a house of mourning. And you can take great confidence from knowing that you are secure. So that first reason we must not carve a smile over all the difficult things in life is because we need the perspective of suffering. We need the perspective of the house of mourning because it puts us in our place and stops our heart being captivated and stops us making foolish decisions based on being captivated by that house of celebration. Well, almost as quickly as Qehelet champions the wonders of this wisdom, we're struck with the cold, hard reality of our broken world once again. It really wouldn't be Ecclesiastes if we had something awesome. Yeah, this seems good. Verses 13 and 14. Consider the work of God. Who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful. And in the day of adversity, consider. God has made the one as well as the other, so that man may not find out anything that will be after him. Qehelet's logic here goes like this. God in his sovereignty ordains both good times and bad times for people to walk through. Times that cannot be changed by sheer human willpower. We can't make straight what God has made crooked. But because all of humanity is walking through these good and bad times, regardless of their belief or unbelief in God, there is no way that we can ever hope to know what our future holds for us. It is hevel. It is vapor, unable to be grasped. If I can jump ahead one verse into next week's passage, verse 15. In my vain life I have seen everything. There is a righteous man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs his life in evil doing. We have wise and foolish, righteous and wicked, but it seems to make no difference whatsoever, because righteously wise people can still suffer, while foolishly wicked people still live in luxury. So now this wisdom that has been championed isn't all that it's cracked up to be. Because even if you are wise and righteous, even if you learn your lessons in the house of mourning, it doesn't guarantee you'll one day get the house of feasting. That's not guaranteed. There's no black and white way out of this for us. It gives no guarantees about our future. Wisdom seemed good when we're learning the lesson, but I've learned enough lessons, God. It's time for a bit of feasting. It's not guaranteed. Who can know what is after us? We like to think that if we follow the rules, if we love God, while we might not be showered with riches, we'll at least have a smooth life with no trials or no difficulties. We'll find that person that will marry us and we'll live happily ever after. We'll have children when we want to have children. We'll have enough money to get a house at some point, to own a little bit of Australia. We'll be pretty healthy throughout our lives. These are the normal comforts we all expect. And if I just do the right thing, if I just follow all the rules, then that's what I will get. I don't really want the mega prosperity. I just want comfort. But listen to this. I have known many people, and I'm pretty sure you've known them too, who have a vital and passionate faith in Jesus. People who fear him, love him, and seek him in all their lives. They want to honor him with their lives. But they are people who face real trials, depression, anxiety, chronic illness, a mongrel boss who bullies them in the workplace, the sting of cancer, loneliness, oppression. And I'm not just talking about little speed bumps that they go through in their life. I'm talking about brick walls that they crash into and never get past. I know people who've lived huge portions of their life in the house of mourning and they die in the house of mourning, and they are some of the most godly people I have known. And then you look around the world and you see a world that ignores Jesus, rejects his truth, scoffs at his way of life, mocks at his very existence, and yet they coast on through. They experience wealth, health, success, happiness, prosperity. Everything falls into place for them. Like Kehelet, we know what it is to see the righteous suffer while the wicked prosper. So while wisdom is a good thing, and when we get into the house of mourning, we can learn so much from being there, that wisdom is havel. It's a vapor. It's a mist. It's a cloud. I can't catch it. Why? Because it doesn't actually guarantee a good life for me. Following that wisdom doesn't mean that everything will fall into place. So why bother? Why bother? Why would I spend time in the house of mourning to gain wisdom when it gives me no guarantee of eventually coming out into the house of feasting? Why is the wisdom of God so havel? Why can't we grasp it? Why can't we unlock the key to God's wisdom so that we can benefit from it? Why can't man find out what will come after him? Well, if we could, we would corrupt it. We would corrupt it in a millisecond. We would use this secret knowledge to twist God's arm into coming through for us. In other words, we would pursue wisdom and righteousness for the sole purpose of gaining a good life for ourselves. Like the whole prosperity doctrine. I will follow all of God's rules. I will have lots of faith so that he has to come through for me and bless me in the end. This is why God ordains that suffering and blessing aren't commodities that can be controlled, certainties that can be predicted, or else we would pursue wisdom to get the blessings rather than truly trusting the one who is the source of all wisdom and blessing. Every one of us in this room knows what it's like to make a bargain with God, don't we? I reckon we've all been there. God, if you bless me with prosperity, how much more effective will I be in giving to missions? God, if you lead me to my wife, I'll give up my porn addiction. God, if you heal my friend, then I will dedicate my life to you. We know what it is to make bargains with God, to try and twist his arm and think that if I do all the right things, if I get all the wisdom, if I do all the righteous stuff, then God has to come through for me. These bargains are rooted in a shallow view of how life works and a pervasive pride that thinks we can either twist God's arm to bless us or straighten what God has made crooked. You know, we're that proud sometimes that God has caused us to walk a crooked path, a difficult path, a rocky path, a path that's led into the house of mourning, and we think, nah, that's not right. I'm going to fix it. I'm going to make straight what God has made crooked. That's a flawed understanding of God. And a flawed understanding of the world that he has given us to live in. And this is the second reason that we need to fight the urge to carve a smile over everything in our life. It's because the confusing things in life, the suffering, the house of mourning, it shows us the limitations of a shallow wisdom and protects us from thinking that we can twist God's arm in our favor. This is what Kehelet is trying to get up. Why he seems so serious all the time. Because carving a smile over the depressing, the sorrowful, or the ugly parts of life skews our perspective, causing us to make foolish decisions because we long to be in the house of feasting instead of the house of mourning. And it leaves us with a shallow view of how God works. In short, it placates us with pleasantries and shelters us from the fact that we're actually desperately needy of God, that we are the ones who are dependent on Him, not the ones who can make straight what He has made crooked, not the ones who can twist His arm in our favor. But as I'm sure you've seen throughout this series, what Kohelet leaves us with here is largely unsatisfying. We might have a better perspective now. Maybe we've even got a more robust understanding of wisdom, but some of you might be here thinking, Joe, I've spent far too long in the house of mourning. I've had enough sorrow and suffering. I've had all I can take. I'm getting smashed on every side, and nothing about it seems good. If there were lessons to learn, I have learnt them, and I'm sick of learning them. It seems a bit rich for Kohelet telling us to spend more time in the house of mourning than the house of feasting, to spend more time dwelling on death days rather than birthdays. But where Kohelet leaves us in this giant pit of Havel, grasping for something that makes sense, God would eventually shine His light of certainty down into that pit. Think about this. Jesus came to earth. Think about this. When Jesus came to earth, where did He come from? He came from the ultimate house of feasting, didn't He? He came from the ultimate house of celebration. He came from heaven. The glory of the triune God existed forever before our minds could even comprehend. Father, Son, Spirit, one in unity, glory, joy. He came from the most joyous and beautiful house of feasting of all time. And where did He choose to go? To the house of mourning that is this earth. Every single step that Jesus made on this earth was in a house of mourning compared to His rightful dwelling place in the house of feasting. He left the ultimate house of celebration to dwell in this pit of sorrow and suffering and mourning. And more than that, even the way He chose to live when He was here, He chose to move away from the places of victory and embrace the places of sorrow. He was born where? In an animal shelter. He lived His life without a place to lay His head. He was rejected and abandoned, and eventually He died crucified as an outcast. Where? On the rubbish dump. Every step from His birth to His death, Jesus constantly left the houses of celebration to dwell in the house of mourning. If you find yourself this afternoon in a house of mourning, if sickness, sin, and sorrow have beaten you down, if you've tried finding something to grasp onto, but it forever slips through your fingers, then surely the Jesus who left the house of celebration to enter the house of mourning is something that you can cling to. Historically, let me tell you this. Those in the house of celebration have rejected Jesus, largely. I mean, who was it that flocked to Him when He was here on earth? Was it the rich, the successful, the winners, those who controlled culture, those who lived in the house of feasting? No, it was those whose lives were a house of mourning, the sick, the broken, the lame, and the lost. Jesus actually tells us He came for those in the house of mourning. So if you are in the house of mourning right now, if your life has been defined by a house of mourning, Jesus stepped out of His house of celebration and entered your house of mourning to find you and give you something more than Havel to cling to give you the real, tangible presence of God to hold on to, a God who would come into your house of mourning and mourn alongside you. If you have never considered Jesus before, can I encourage you? Jesus is not sitting in his house of celebration, lording it over us like some king in a castle, just looking down over peasants. Jesus Christ left the ultimate house of celebration and entered a house of mourning so that mourners like you and me would flock to him and find hope. Can I appeal to you this evening that if your life is a house of mourning, that's where Jesus is. And you just reach out to him, find him there next to you in your suffering, and have someone that you can cling to for the rest of your life, whether you ever get a house of celebration or not. You will have an eternal home of celebration alongside him when judgment day comes. And you can take that to the bank. I'm going to pray, but if you don't know Jesus tonight, if you're just here investigating who he is and whether he might be for you, can I ask you as I pray to consider that and maybe for the first time this evening, reach out to him and grab hold of the one who is in the house of mourning with you. Let's pray.